Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to be joined by Jessel Noor from the Real News Network, who has been reporting on the long game that some progressive organizers are playing in red areas of swing states and how they are trying to overcome the Fox News effect, the kind of propaganda stream that makes a lot of Americans privilege their tribal resentments and phony grievances over, you know, their material well-being. It's something we need more of. This week, the Washington Post obtained a recording of a staff meeting at CBS News earlier this month where News co-president Neeraj Kemlani, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, told reporters that Democrats were almost certainly going to lose in the midterms, that Republicans were almost certainly going to take over after the midterms is what I should say. And Kemlani was setting the stage for hiring Trump's former chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, among others, as a regular contributor. This led to a lot of blowback. And it's hard to overstate how, you know, broken our media is when they're looking for insights from Mick Mulvaney, who, if you'll recall, admitted that Trump had extorted Ukraine to get dirt on Joe Biden, to fabricate dirt on Joe Biden, and then told the media that they should get over it. To do so now, right now, to turn to that guy when both new revelations about Trump's efforts to overturn the election are coming out all the time, and Ukraine is trying to, stave off an invasion by Russia, it's mind-boggling. Anyway, the quote is, so again, this is CBS News co-president Neeraj Kemlani. If you look at some of the people that we've been hiring on a contributor basis, being able to make sure that we are getting access to both sides of the aisle is a priority because we know the Republicans are going to take over. And he added, again, I quote, a lot of the people that we're bringing in are helping us in terms of access to that side of the equation. My problem with this really is that, you know, we are dealing with an ongoing coup attempt from the right, multifaceted. We've talked about it on the show a lot, and they're just pretending that everything is normal. They're just pretending that this is, you know, a midterm contest like any other. Maybe, tax hikes will be decided, and they're not treating it like it's a contest for the future of our democracy, which it clearly is. Clearly is. And the media has decided that the midterms are guaranteed to be a bloodbath for Democrats. And while that may prove to be true, I've talked about this on the show before. As I speak right now, Republicans have a 2-point advantage in 538's average of generic ballot polls. That is the polls that just ask, oh, would you support a Democrat or Republican for Congress if the election were held today? And doesn't ask, you know, doesn't say the names of the people who might be running for those offices. So they have a 2-point advantage on that. And at this point in 2018, just for perspectives, Democrats had a 7.6-point lead in that measure. So, you know, of course, the election won't be held today. A lot can change in 7 months, and real candidates will run in those races. So, I mean, I say all of this because I'm concerned that it'll be like a self-fulfilling prophecy. In other news, Truth Social, Donald Trump's MAGA alternative to Twitter, is not doing well. It's doing poorly. It was reported this week that there has been a 93% decline in new downloads since some initial enthusiasm when the site was rolled out, or the application. Lots of users continue to have problems accessing the site or using it. It's a turd burger, and there's a lot of Schadenfreude over this. The people who are not fans of Donald Trump are kind of celebrating this turn, and just for example, Devin Nunes, the wingnut former chair of the House Intelligence Committee, gave up a safe congressional seat to run the company, and there's lots of gloating on Twitter about that. Comparisons to Trump's past bankrupt enterprises are being floated around, but I think it's so funny that people think of this as a failure, right? That Truth Social is a failure. This was, you know, it's a failure in that it hasn't displaced Twitter. But I would point out that the investment vehicle for this centerpiece of Trump's new media empire raised $1.25 billion from institutional investors. Billion with a B. At one point, it was valued at over $3 billion, right? I think this has to be one of Trump's greatest successes ever. It's certainly one of his biggest grifts ever, right? He has monetized this stupid, like, grievance-driven conspiracy theories about how social medias are supposedly being like so mean and unfair to conservatives for reasons that they never specify because cancel culture or whatever. And he's monetized those grievances in such a big way. I mean, we don't know what he pocketed in all of this, or, you know, whether they're he short-sold, he and his cronies and his family. And I hope we one day that we do learn exactly how much he fleeced the rubes for, the MAGA faithful for, with this project. But it certainly isn't a failure, not a failure at all. Let's see what else. I was trying to get a segment on the war in Ukraine together this week, but we did not manage to book an expert from the region, which was my goal. I didn't want to get. And it's easy to get Western analysts. I felt like I didn't want another Western perspective. I really wanted to talk to a Russia observer who is in Russia, or at least in the region. And I will get that for you soon. We're working on it. We had some scheduling issues, really. But I just want to briefly note a stunningly stupid talking point that has emerged on the pro-Russia right and in some like so-called contrarian circles. And this narrative holds that Vladimir Putin did not miscalculate at all with this war. This is all going according to his brilliant plan. And in this telling, his true goals were always much more modest than toppling the Ukrainian government and installing a friendly puppet. He just wanted to solidify his position in the East, or gain control of Ukrainian gas, and all of the rest, all of this disastrous fighting was just a feint. It's just a feint. So he meant to do this. He meant to try and then fail to take Kyiv. He meant to try and fail to push eastward and try and fail to decapitate the Ukrainian government. And Brett Stevens, the columnist, took this line in the New York Times. Glenn Greenwald, noted wingnut, trotted it out. It's just, again, remarkably detached from reality, frighteningly detached from reality. The Washington Post reported this week that Putin is being misled by his senior defense officials about what is going on in Ukraine to this day. He's been giving a sunny picture, a misleadingly sunny picture of what's going on. Various intelligence agencies in the West, the U.S. intelligence community and the Brits as well, say that he's being fed this yes men are being just telling him flattering things. You will also recall, or you may recall, that he placed several members of his own intelligence services under house arrest, accusing them of predicting that the Russians would be greeted as liberators and that this would all be a cakewalk misleading him in that sense. And according to a whole bunch of reporting, that overly rosy view, both then and now, so before the invasion and now, has cost the Russian military effort in all sorts of ways. They were sent in without clear lines of command or the proper logistics and equipment for a protracted conflict. Their encrypted communication systems didn't work. They actually destroyed a bunch of their own equipment in air raids. So they resorted to communicating in the open. This has contributed to 7 Russian generals being killed on the battlefield. And I guess this is, and one of the defense officials who spoke to the Washington Post made this point. He said, well, you know, in a autocratic system, you don't have people who feel empowered to be like, this is a crazy idea, right? When you have someone like Vladimir Putin, who intimidates his advisors and is someone you don't want to cross, you tend to get bad information. So the benefits of that system, of course, is there's no bureaucracy. You can make a fast decision. They're efficient, but you can just be following your own, you know, bullshit into a quagmire, which is what we've seen so far. But it's all going swimmingly, according to Brett Stevens. Just, it's all going well. And by the way, I'm just talking about the military side. Of course, Russia's economy is being absolutely gutted by the sanctions regime. That was also caused by what? Miscalculating and being told by his advisors that it wouldn't be that bad, that they could, you know, survive any kind of Western sanctions. The Western sanctions would be moderate. And that is not what turned out to be. I mean, Russia's air travel industry is basically going to end up mostly grounded shortly. And the customers for its primary exports, energy, are all furiously trying to replace that supply. All right. So it's a heck of a plan. If that's Putin's plan, it's a heck of a plan. And on that note, let's just take a quick break and come right back with Jessel Noor, who has a positive story to share with us. Stay tuned. I slammed the door when I come into the bedroom, because I'm the king of the castle. Turn me on, turn me loose. Try to hit it, it's a hassle. Come get some of this. Don't forget the innuendo. Play me like this and go. Never ever let go. Keep it so loud, you may hit him the crescendo. Welcome back. You know, regular listeners know that I'm always on the lookout for positive or at least encouraging stories in these dark days. I'm joined now by Jessel Noor. He's a host, producer, and reporter with the Real News Network. And he has been reporting on some, let's say, encouraging efforts to organize voters in Trump country, in rural America. Jessel, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with me this week. Jessel has been reporting on this from rural Pennsylvania and recently did a piece on organizers' work in some Trumpy areas of North Carolina. You can check out those stories, by the way, at The Real News, which is all one word, .com. When I see these kind of temper tantrums by angry folks on the right, we've talked on this show about how there's a backlash cycle, and we're kind of at the bad point in the backlash cycle. And you know, when I talk about these angry folks, you can call them Tea Partiers. At one point, we did. They're the same folks at the pro-Trump rallies, the Trump truck parades, freedom convoys, whatever form it is. I see a lot of like goofiness and conspiracism, but I also see organizing, like grassroots level organizing, that gives folks a sense of you know, belonging to a community, and, you know, urges them to get involved in local politics and school boards and the like. And it often seems to me that there's a real asymmetry there, in the sense that, you know, what you get Democrats and various progressive groups trying to turn out the vote in election years, but other than a weakened labor movement, there isn't, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of effort out there to engage people where they live. But then reading your recent reporting, Jessel, suggests that there are some folks on the broad left who are trying to change that. Let me first ask you, what is deep canvassing? What does that term mean?
Yeah. And, you know, I really appreciate you taking the time to shed the light, to shed, you know, a light on the story, because yes, you know, we, as the media, we tend to focus on all the negative things that are happening in the world. And, you know, thanks to this grant from Solutions Journalism, I'm able to focus on some solutions. And so one of the solutions, you know, I've come across is deep canvassing. And so, you know, your viewers will have probably been canvassed by, you know, a political campaign before, where they just come knock on your door and they tell you to vote for a candidate or support a cause. And, you know, research has shown that's not very effective, especially when you're trying to persuade people that have different, you know, differing opinions. Deep canvassing, although it sounds similar, it is, it couldn't be more different, because you're not trying to convince someone to vote for something. You're not trying to pitch a candidate. You are asking them how they feel about something. So what people will tell you is that it doesn't feel like you're coming at, they're being approached from a political perspective. It seems like someone is coming to them to talk to them. And especially when you're talking to people in rural communities, you're talking to people even in, you know, one of the stories I did was in Milwaukee. People in communities that feel like they are, you know, have been neglected, feel like they've been disinvested, feel like, you know, the powers to be aren't addressing their needs. That is a really good place to come to them, right? Like, how's it going? You know, what do you need? How are you doing? And then the conversation goes to, you know, how do you feel about these things? So how do you feel about the pandemic bailout? How do you feel about, you know, the election? And so how it works is they ask about emotions, and then they share stories about how these topics affected them. And then they ask the person to share stories as well. And so, you know, when it comes to the pandemic, when it comes to even elections, you know, it turns out people make decisions based on emotions. And if you ask people about them, which, you know, it's rarely done in our society, I'm guilty of it. I tend to spend way more time yelling at people online than actually trying to have a meaningful conversation.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, when you actually have this conversation, you're able to understand where your mutual interests lie, where you have a connection, and then they're able to build empathy. And, you know, especially on the right, when so much of the politics is based on racial animosity, on dog whistle politics, and no one has actually talked to them about, wait, why do you feel like that? You know, like, what led you to feel like that? You know, why are you opposed to these mass mandates? Has there ever been a time when you had to make a sacrifice to help someone else, right? No one asks these questions. No one has these conversations. And it, you know, and as the data has shown, and you know, you've done reporting on this, this, it turns out, is, you know, and one study showed deep canvassing was 100 times more effective than traditional political canvassing, especially among rural voters.
Yeah. And these voters, they, you know, it is part of a very common narrative that they've been looked down upon, and they've been ignored, and they've been, you know, condescended to by liberal elites. This is, of course, something that they're told all the time in the conservative media, et cetera, et cetera. And there's, you know, there's the simultaneous view that you have kind of these predatory, you know, people of color and stuff coming to get your stuff from below. So you're squoze between kind of an elite on top of you and, you know, parasitic foreigners and all of that beneath you. And I think it's important to understand that when you try to connect with people in a way that isn't explicitly political. Like if you come and you knock on the door and you have, oh, I have some literature for this politician or this cause, you get past people's instinctive kind of partisan guards. And you spoke with organizers, with a couple of affiliated groups. Just recently spoke with people from Pennsylvania Stands Up and Down Home North Carolina. And they talked about encountering, you know, people who have hold racial stereotypes, a lot of racial grievance. How do they overcome that? You know, because you get fed a steady diet of these, you know, grievances, these tribal racial grievances. It's difficult to connect with people who are different from you in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not, you know, it's not easy. It's not easy because, you know, everything these people have ever been told, you know, is based on, you know, is based on the idea that, yeah, like, people of color are lazy or people of color are coming to steal your jobs. And that's why you're in the place you are. So yeah, it's definitely not easy, but they have, you know, through deep canvassing, and I know we're going to talk about race class narrative as well.
Yes.
You know, they have come up with a really effective strategy where they, you know, and one of the, and, you know, a lot of canvassing has gone to switched over to the phone instead of knocking on doors. And one of the canvassers I talked to in North Carolina, Bonnie Dobson, she's African-American, but, you know, the people she talks to can't tell. She doesn't have an accent. So the people she talks to can't tell she's African-American. So she gets on the phone, asks people how they're doing. She, you know, she asks them, you know, how the COVID bailouts are going or how unemployment, you know, what do they think about how the government has handled the pandemic and in terms of unemployment insurance. And so Bonnie had a conversation with a self-identifying Latinx person who, a Latinx man who said, you know, I like the idea of unemployment, but, you know, but he said, you know, but Black people are lazy. You know, they just sit around in the projects and use the money to buy cars and drugs. And so, you know, she heard him out and, you know, it's easy to get as a Black woman, I'm sure it, you know, she was upset by that, but instead yes. of, but, you know, and she, but you know, that's part of her job is to listen to these people's concerns. And then she said, you know, well, you know, as you know, I'm African-American and that hasn't been my experience. And if, and like, she's like, you know, that hasn't been the experience in my community and, you know, the people I've interacted with. And in fact, you know, I've never had to rely on unemployment, but if I did, I'm really glad that service exists because that's the point. Everyone gets on hard times, you know, it can happen to anyone and it's great that service exists. And, you know, and they don't try to drop a lot of data because it's just about having conversations. But in that conversation, she said like, you know, in fact, the majority of people that are on, you know, public services are actually white. They're white rural people. And so, you know, she's able to share some information and then, you know, just have that connection, you know, like, has there been a time when you needed help from someone else to survive, right? Like to get by, like, what did that feel like? And then, you know, with the race class narrative, she talks about how, you know, it's really, you know, in her opinion, it's really, you know, what this guy's hearing is what the elite is, what the, you know, the elites, the conservatives want you to think. So people don't work together. Working class people don't work together to build power and actually, you know, have policies and elect politicians that actually will actually serve our interests. You know, and you know, you go to rural North Carolina, you go to rural Pennsylvania, and it's pretty easy to argue that, you know, the political system isn't working in these people's interests. And so once they're able to have those conversations and sort of break through that sound, doesn't work for everybody. But, you know, from what the organizers have said and what their data shows, they're able, you know, this is a successful strategy and it's not going to convert Trump country overnight. You know, they acknowledge it's a generational fight, but they're able to sway people and able to build, you know, able to build empathy and able to help people understand a different perspective and, you know, sway voters, you know, help change their opinion. And, you know, this deep canvassing really isn't a strategy that is like a one-time thing. it has to be, you know, because you're countering the dominant narrative in our society, right? So to do this, it has to be a sustained effort. You have to go back to these same communities over and over again, year in and year out, but it's shown that it can succeed.
So we've gotten a little bit of ahead of ourselves, just in the sense that we've talked about this. We've referred to the race class narrative, but we haven't really defined that for listeners. And it is a way specifically of reframing a lot of our more vicious political debates. What is this race class narrative?
Race class narrative is the idea that, in a very simple way, the idea that as an organizing tool, it's important to put race and class in the forefront of discussions. And we've seen what happens when Democrats don't do this, right? We know what happened in Virginia when Democrats really didn't have a cohesive response to the lies about critical race theory. So the idea is you address race and you address class, and you have a narrative that shows why, the interests, and what they're doing in North Carolina, why it's in the people's interest to build multiracial cross-class solidarity, why the interests of, racial minorities and white people are the same, and why, the politics of fear and scapegoating is against the interests of, working people of color.
I've written a little bit about the race class narrative, and one of the things that I think is important to understand is that it does two things at the same time. When they've done a lot of studies on how people respond to hearing this, that it's, that people are intentionally dividing you by race in order to screw you over. That's the central message. And what they've done, they've tested these against this race class narrative against a class only narrative, where you just talk to people about, you're getting screwed by the elites, and also against a racial justice alone narrative. And what they find is that when you go to and talk to people of color, they are not motivated to the same degree by a race neutral class narrative, because they think that that's not about them, that they're not going to reap the benefits of whatever you are talking to them about, because their lived experience is that they are not, that they don't receive those benefits. So if you say, look, we're going to expand healthcare, they think, I'm going to get screwed here. So it's important to understand that it gets over the primary purpose in terms of reaching out to white communities that feel alienated, is to get past the idea of these long standing racial grievances. By the way, I'm just going to throw this out there because it's related to this conversation. This new study just dropped that when you talk to people, to white people, about racial disparities in COVID-19's impact, we say, oh, this is a pandemic that is devastating communities of color in a disproportional degree. It lowers support for safety precautions, for taking, for mask mandates, et cetera, et cetera. So this race class narrative is pushing back against a strategy that the right has long understood. Jessel, you talked about how this is a longer term project than traditional canvassing. And in your pieces, you talk about how it's also a lot more time and resource intensive than traditional door knocking. It requires more training. What is the theory for converting these repeated contacts into better policy outcomes or a better political landscape over the long term for progressive goals? How do you capitalize on this work?
Yeah. So the group, the national group, advocacy group, People's Action, is really spearheading a lot of the deep canvassing efforts. And so what they are doing specifically is targeting rural counties in swing states. And as we know, rural counties in swing states have a disproportionate impact on our elections on a state level and a national level, not to even mention, you know, the Electoral College. So the idea is that, you know, as we know, progressive policies tend to poll pretty well among these populations. But, you know, as you explained, you know, way better than I did, there are, you know, significant barriers to achieving, you know, there's challenges to, you know, actually converting the popularity of programs into, you know, political gains. So the idea is, you know, they, you know, and yes, and that is definitely one of the limitations and the challenges of the strategy. It is, you know, more cost intensive, and it requires constant training, constant reflection. But what People's Action did, and they partnered with a number of groups like Down Home North Carolina and Pennsylvania Stands Up, is they deployed this strategy in the lead up to the 2020 election. And I think it was like seven, maybe. Yeah, it was a number of swing states, rural counties, in early 2020. And, you know, they found that even on a short term level, this can succeed. And, you know, they were able to use, you know, to deploy this in the lead up to the election. And, you know, they would argue help contribute to Biden's margin of victory in the 2020 election. You know, groups deployed it. One of the groups was Song Power in Georgia in the runoff elections, the Senate runoff elections in January of 2021. So on the short term, progressives feel like they can use this to score, you know, victories and to help you know, secure victories on, you know, in electoral field. Long term, though, you know, they want to use these strategies to really help build support for progressive causes, and help, you know, help Democrats win back these working class voters that, you know, conservatives have swayed, you know, help build support for Medicaid expansion in states where Republicans have blocked it, help build support for Medicare for All. One of the projects in the summer of 2020 was help build support for defund. And in Pennsylvania, you know, that, you know, what that ended up in Harrisburg, what that ended up translating to was they canvassed in the summer of 20, had support, you know, helped gain support for defund, and that translated into increased funding for an eviction moratorium and money for renters, because people, there was awareness raised on how much they're spending on police and what they're not spending money on, and by having these discussions, it led to organizing and it led to, you know, a victory there. So I think it is a mix of, you know, short-term strategy, long-term strategy, but through this messaging, through this, you know, going back to the same neighborhoods, going back to the same communities, helping have these conversations, I think, I mean, they're really trying to transform politics in America. And I think, you know, this is one of the places where you actually see, you know, see some success on the political front, like making inroads into places that Democrats have abandoned. You know, in Alamance County, where Down Home North Carolina is concentrating a lot of their efforts, you know, they haven't voted for a Democratic president since Jimmy Carter. Okay, it's deep red, but they had the first Black woman run for county commissioner, and she got like 30,000 votes. She didn't win, but, you know, she had the most votes ever by a Democrat, you know, in recent memory, and she made significant inroads. They elected the first Latino House representative in 2020 in North Carolina. So they're shifting the culture, they're shifting politics, they know it's a long-term fight, but, you know, they are putting the resources in and they're, you know, and they're putting the self-reflection in, they're having these trainings. And I think, you know, they're helping really launch this movement, which, you know, gives me hope. And it's engaged a lot of people that don't necessarily want to engage in the typical politics that exist.
Yeah, that's really important. And I should probably say here, in the interest of very full disclosure and probably unnecessarily full disclosure, that I'm a supporter of the group that Jessel just mentioned. It's called People's Action. And my state's affiliate group, which is called Citizen Action of New York, I'm not a big donor or anything like that, but I've gone to a couple meetings. And if you're interested in getting involved in this kind of work, I would encourage you to do so. You should check out what they're doing at peoplesaction.org. There's a list of all the local groups there. So you can find a local affiliate that's doing this deep canvassing, that's trying to use the race class narrative to kind of change minds and make people more empathetic. You can get involved where you live. I live in a place that's kind of a microcosm of America. It's a blue town in central New York, surrounded by Trump country. You get out of town, you know, we have a progressive mayor, this very progressive in town. You get out of town, gets rural very fast, and immediately you start seeing like giant flags that say "fuck Joe Biden." People are flying those things. Jessel, I meant to ask you earlier, what initially got you interested in this story? You know, we always hear so much about how hostile rural America is to progressive values, how we've lost rural America. And it seems like the legacy media is obsessed with, you know, talking to these folks about their grievances.
Yeah. So I would just quickly, you know, piggyback on your last comment. I attended a couple of People's Actions trainings as part of my reporting. And what's I think really powerful is that anyone can deep canvas. These are skills, you know, you can use throughout your daily life. And as part of the training, you actually make phone calls. You know, they have like multiple trainings every month, and you can actually make phone calls, and they have different campaigns. I attended one where they were calling voters in North Carolina to help build support for a clean energy initiative. So, you know, I think your listeners will definitely, you know, look up People's Action. You can join the trainings. I think it's worthwhile to check it out.
So
I'm glad you asked that question, because before I got into this reporting, I was extremely skeptical of the idea of deep canvassing. My partner is involved in an organization, you know, that does research on this topic, and she's telling me about it, and I'm just like, this sounds crazy. You're not going to go to Trump country and win people over. I was extremely skeptical, but spent a lot of time on Twitter the last couple of years, and not too much time, you know, interacting in the real world because of the pandemic. So I had lost my sort of like lost hope in humanity in a sense, and the idea that we can win people over and sway people that have such, you know, diametrically opposed worldviews than us. But I mentioned this grant from Solutions Journalism, and that gave me an opportunity to spend a lot of time doing research into the groups that are working, you know, in swing states, you know, because as we know, these handful of counties, these handful of swing states are going to determine, you know, the presidential election, are going to determine the control of the Senate, are going to determine who controls the House. And so I wanted to focus, you know, on the specific areas that will determine the future of America, basically. And of course, that research I found, you know, I wanted to report on, after these last couple years of extremely, you know, difficult times for us as a society and for my family, I needed some positive news. So I was able to find, you know, some groups in Milwaukee, you know, America's most segregated city, that are not doing the typical thing. You know, they're, you know, and the same thing in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Georgia, groups that aren't doing the typical thing, they're actually working to build genuine community power. And, you know, we know that's where change really happens, right? On a community level, on a neighborhood level. And, you know, the folks that are putting, you know, dedicating their lives to do this, that are taking on these biggest challenge, the biggest challenges we face. I found that so inspiring, and I, you know, I got to spend time with the folks, in Milwaukee, the group Block, Black Leaders Organizing for Change. And I got to do a bunch of interviews with the folks in North Carolina and in Georgia and in Pennsylvania. And, you know, a lot of this work is being led by women of color, which I find also very inspiring. They're putting themselves, you know, on the front line of these movements as they typically do. And, you know, as part of this grant from Solutions Journalism, you know, I need evidence. I need evidence that these strategies are working, and they have it. You know, they have the evidence that this is increasing, these strategies are increasing turnout. They're, you know, they're winning elections. They're making historic gains in places that haven't, you know, where Democrats have written off or ignored, or they only come around, you know, once every 4 years. And I find that inspiring. And a lot of it is people that are, you know, want to give back to their neighborhoods, want to give back to their communities. And a lot of this organizing came after the 2016 election, and people wanted to know, you know, what went wrong and how to fix it and how to engage people. In Wisconsin, you know, they have one of the harshest voter ID laws. In North Carolina, they have, you know, voter suppression, they have gerrymandering, which is also the same in many of these rural states. And so they're facing, you know, serious, and with the lack of, you know, federal voting rights protection, they're facing serious obstacles, but they see hope in their communities. They're inspired by their communities, and to document that, to speak to them, really sort of energized me. And I've got a few more states to cover as part of this grant, and then I'll be continuing this work, you know, throughout this, over the course of this year. And I am really excited to connect with folks, you know, that are doing this work and that are on the front lines. And yeah, it is like I'm saying, like, it is inspiring to see that. And I think, you know, and I'm thankful for Solutions Journalism, because I get a chance to focus on what the actual solutions are and the people leading the charge. And I'm really thankful for that opportunity.
Well, I'm thankful for you taking the time to talk to me about it, share this stuff with our audience. Jess Elnor, I believe we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
I would also like to thank David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I would like to thank the good folks at Raw Story and Alternate for supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, and you can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, I would like to thank all of you fine, very discerning people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.